All right, so I think that's us going now. So, Glenn, my first question in these oral history interviews is always just at what point in your life and how did you come to work in what was back then community business but eventually became social enterprise?
I saw an advert for a job at Leap in late 1980, possibly November or December 1980. And Leap was expanding from a kind of one-person John Pierce organisation into a four-person organisation. So there would be John, there'd be two development workers and one training education type worker. I just finished a job in housing, working on a major housing project, and I had my degree was in sort of public admin and economics, and then I'd done an MBA directly after it. So the whole idea of this community-based employment was something I could see how that could be useful, particularly given the kind of UK political context at the time, which I'll maybe mention in a minute. So I applied for the job and I got interviewed in January 81, but I didn't get the job. But very shortly after that, I did get a job also at Paisley College in the local government unit. The local government unit sponsored LEAP. So LEAP was part of the local government unit. So funnily enough, I found myself working with the LEAP staff, which was John, Margaret Lindsay, Colin Roxburgh and Duncan McTavish. Not working directly on the same projects. I worked in kind of research things on local government, but by 82, John asked me to do tidy up the Flagstone Enterprises case study, for example, and then in 83, I started work on the Govan Workspace case study. So again, apart from all the sort of other things I was doing, I was getting involved in quite a lot of research on community business, as we called it then, and thoroughly enjoyed it. Thoroughly enjoyed doing the Govan Workspace case study. And then it kind of leap transitioned in 84 into Strathclyde Community Business, which was again another expansion. So you've gone from a John Pierce one person outfit from 78 to 81 to Leap One, which was Leap One was John Pierce 78, 81. Then you had Leap Two, which was 81, 84, and then Leap, which was really just a division of a research part of Paisley College, became an independent company, a Strathclyde Community Business Limited, in 84, and that existed in that format to 91. During that time, people like John, Colin, Duncan, myself were involved. So it went through various transitions, got a bit more serious, got a bit more money. The impact, I think, got bigger and bigger, but you know, and it got as a sort of movement, as we called it at the time, it got more visible. So I'm probably best qualified to talk about it in the 80s. I mean, I kind of went away back into housing in the 90s, and then I came back to social enterprise latterly in my career, and it was quite interesting reflecting on what we were doing in the 80s and what I came back to, and in many ways not an awful lot had changed, you know. There were still a lot of the same issues, so that's like exactly what we were saying earlier on about how little changes and how little people, you know, take on the lessons learned. But I mean, that's not unique to social or community enterprise, community business, whatever we call it. You know, politicians find that out all the time. Everything's just wheel of reinvention at the end of the day, you know.
Mm-hmm. Great. So that's a really nice summary of how you got, how the things progressed. Could we maybe go back to 1981 then, and just talk about a bit more about like a day-to-day work that you were involved in at that time, and the kind of projects you were doing, and why you were shaping them in the way that you did.
Yeah, well, my role in the local government unit at Paisley was much more about local government research. So, I mean, I wasn't, as I say, directly involved in the day-to-day side of LEAP, which was the Colin and Duncan side, John. But I was aware of what they were doing, and, you know, obviously when I kind of made the transition to going over to SCB in 84, you were working much more kind of cold, we called it cold face sometimes, which was quite interesting because the miners' strike was on in 84, 85, and I was reflecting on a couple of things just before coming into, you know, coming in for this interview. I mean, Brexit strikes me as like the current version of the miners' strike. The miners' strike went on for a year. It was desperate. It was on the news every day, and it was just, what I do remember, you know, it's hard now to remember 35 years ago, or just a wee bit. I mean, the Thatcher government came in 79, and they immediately took on the steelworkers, and they broke that strike. Steelworkers went on strike and basically had to go back for nothing, really. And then, of course, the miners' strike started in 84, and it really wasn't a strike about pay or anything. It was a strike about pit closures. And it went on for a year, and it was heartbreaking to see what was happening. So you had this collapse of traditional industries going on, and particularly in Scotland, which was manufacturing industry oriented at that time. Can't remember the exact figure, but I'd be surprised if a third to 40% of the population didn't work in manufacturing. I think we're down to about 16% or something now. I mean, so the collapse of manufacturing industry was felt all the more in Scotland. So you had iron and steel collapsing, you had shipbuilding collapsing, you had mine working just getting finished everywhere. So huge numbers of unemployed. And like Scotland had the unemployment number in Scotland in 1984 was something like 360,000. It was running at 15-20%. It was unbelievable. So people like us were trying to work in communities that had been just ravaged by it all, you know, and it was just awful. Because I mean, I'm trying not to paint too desperate a picture, but I mean, you were working in areas that, places that had been built after the war, post-war council schemes that were now 30 years on, or 25, 30 years on, were beginning to feel the effects. The housing stock hadn't been modernised, it was left the way it was built, and, you know, whole communities were just falling apart. Work, which had been, you know, they weren't ever in the scheme, so people had to go out of the schemes to work, so then they couldn't get out of the schemes to work, so, I mean, you know, everything just became a bit more insular, and that's why you had, you know, local reaction and folks saying, well, what can we do to create some sort of opportunities? And the whole community business side of things in Strathclyde certainly was targeted at what were called areas for priority treatment, generally speaking, places which had higher and above unemployment and all the various myriad of social and economic problems that went along with that. So that's how community business was attempting to come up with some new solutions. But I mean, it's quite interesting reading the paperwork down the stairs there. I mean, I'm saying 360,000 people in Scotland were unemployed, and we're working in whatever, 20, 30, 40, 50 areas of Strathclyde with 10, 12, 14 staff or whatever. I mean, there's only so much you can do, you know, to try and get things moving, but it was always the kind of spirit of you know, local folk that kept you going, you know, that you know, it was amazing how some people, I mean, we weren't living in these areas, they were living in them, and it was incredible the guts and determination people were showing to kind of fight back.
Do you remember any particular communities or community meetings that kind of struck you as people who were really giving it their best shot?
Yeah, I mean, you'd go along to meetings at night, and in those days, of course, everyone smoked, or lots of folks smoked. You'd come out of these meetings having smoked 9 million cigarettes or something. But no, I mean, meetings were generally, you know, when people kind of. I think one of the things, again, looking at the paperwork down the stairs, was quite a lot of paperwork. There was quite a lot of articles about how you keep folk involved. I mean, I think that was one of the issues that you came across. It was, you could get folk involved initially, and you'd have the two or three public meetings in the smoke-filled rooms, and, you know, folk would be angry, or they would have energy and enthusiasm, dynamism. It was keeping that going over the piece that was the challenge. I mean, how you keep going over meeting after meeting after meeting when you're getting slapped in the face is bloody, bloody hard. And I think Tommy Clark, who was the chairperson of Cabin Workspace, he summed it up really well in that little Pockets of Hope study, because he said, because that's exactly what they did with Cabin Workspace. There's a direct quote, he says something like, "All officialdom depends on stringing you out until you get fed up and you go away." He says, "The thing is, we didn't go away." And I think that's where it worked, you know, when folks said, "No, we're not taking that, you know, we're not taking that. You're going to have to come up with something better than that, come up with a different solution, or give us some money to do it." And but that, as I say, I think that it wasn't that was the exception, but I mean, it was. You did tend to find the slackening off of interest, the numbers, the enthusiasm. I mean, because it's hard to keep that going when you're getting slapped in the face all the time. And it was really there for only the really, really determined folk that kind of got there.
And so who was it that, you know, local communities were up against? Was it local and district council that were kind of trying to shape things in a different direction? Or what was the dynamics there?
Well, I think for most people in these areas, it was like, they didn't know, well, who are you up against? You know, I mean, like, who... Say you've lived in an area, a council estate, you kind of naturally think, therefore, the council's responsible for things. And it was interesting to read the sort of interview with Colin, because Colin had said about how dependent some people had been, and they couldn't do things because they waited for the council to repair things, you know, and it wasn't their responsibility. Now, he had that one kind of mentality. I'm not sure Colin drew this analogy, but you had that kind of one mentality of the dependency, the council will do it for it. And then you had the kind of the countervailing philosophy coming out from the Thatcher government, which was all about, there's no such thing as society, do it for yourself. You know, society should work by the individual. Individuals should sort things. You know, wealth will trickle down. You know, and we were always saying, no, it doesn't ever happen like that. You know, it never trickles down. It's not in the interest of people up there for it to trickle down. You know, so you've got individual capitalism, if you like, and you've got this kind of malevolent kind of idea, state socialism, whatever another. And I suppose we were doing something in between, trying to, you know, and working with folk who wanted to do something about it, and trying to get the kind of people from all sides of the equation, left, right, centre, whatever, politically, to come together and come up with new models, because that was what was clear by the 70s, was that the post-war consensus about how you did things, Keynesian economics, wasn't working. So therefore, you had what's basically probably going on now. You had a kind of the right-wing answer to it and the left-wing answer. The left-wing answer through Michael Foot was to renationalise, you know, to nationalise things even further, to state control over things. And you had Thatcher, who just wanted to sell off everything because the state couldn't run it. And private sector, private capitalism will run it far better than the state would ever do. And, you know, the folk who were affected in between were just getting shunted from pillar to post. So I suppose that's what we were doing. We were trying to come in and just saying, no, I mean, these two models might work for some people, but they don't work for everyone, you know. So what about having this kind of third way, a third sector idea, which, again, now when you think about how widely social enterprise, as it's called now, is accepted. It's mainstream. It's third sector. It's, you know, and then back then it was like really fundamentally challenged. You know, I mean, it was really only through the dynamism and the energy of a few key councillors in the region, guys like Ron Young and Tony Worthington, who became an MP for Clyde Bank and Bears then. These guys were far-sighted. They were not old-style Labour folk. They were bright intellectuals, basically, with no baggage, no, you know, they're not beholden to anyone. They wanted new solutions. They did. They went to these communities. They saw that the old models didn't work. So you had really good, forward-looking, modern councillors like them. You had a few key officers too, who the guys who were writing the social strategy for the 80s, from the regional council's perspective, you know, radical kind of ideas about it's not working, let's come up with something else, you know, let's do some positive discrimination. So that was what was good, but it did rest on, at times, I thought, very, very few people to keep the thing moving. Most folk would obviously just fall in with the Labour vote, you know, and that was the other thing. Labour just ran everything in Strathclyde. I can't remember the figure, but I think of the 103 councillors in Strathclyde, at one point about 89 of them were Labour, and the city council, it was a similar sort of situation. So you had this kind of municipal Labour thing, but I think for a lot of folk, you know, it seemed like a long way away, and I think that was probably reflected in how votes for local elections started to fall off round about that time. The regional council and the district council, which were the two principal sponsors of Strathclyde Community Business, I mean, I think anyone who was around at the time would tell you there was always that kind of tension between those two authorities. I mean, when you had one authority, district councils, which were responsible for housing and planning, essentially, and the regional council, which had education and social work, the huge money, that was where the huge money was. There was always a kind of creative tension. So we were sort of falling in between kind of chief execs, planning, physical planning side of the region, and the kind of housing planning side of the district. But it would be kind of wrong to think that just because you had a Labour council in Glasgow and a Labour council in the region, that it was all eye to eye stuff. But anyway, they kind of basically both bought into the model. But then you had other organisations involved in Strathclyde Community Business, like the SDA, who, as Colin Roxburgh said in his interview, was, you know, largely ambivalent to the whole idea. You know, this isn't. Can't go into housing schemes because there's no economy there, so we can't do anything. you know, well, why not? You're the government's economic regeneration agency, why can't you? And the MSC, where it was like temporary employment schemes as well. So, and the business community, trying to get the business community, you know, there was a thing called Scottish Business in the Community, which was very good, very liberal in its sort of interpretation of things. And they were a key supporter of Scott Bick, actually. So, you know, most of the time you were operating in that kind of environment.
And what about kind of other types of kind of civic and community infrastructure, you know, things like tenants' associations or trade unions? Did you build from relationships with those types of organisations, or were they not really on the landscape of people you were working with?
I think mostly when people like Colin were doing the kind of early development work in communities, they would be trying to work with anyone, and be that trade unions, tenants associations, people involved. One of the things we particularly tried to do was make the link between community-based responses to housing and community-based responses to, you know, unemployment, economic initiatives, etc. So therefore, for example, in back in December 84, we ran a major conference at the Lawn Hotel in Glasgow, and it was great. There was about 120, 150 folk there, making the link between community-based employment and community-based housing. And we had a very successful conference there, and there were some good, fine examples in the 80s of working together between the community-based associations and ourselves. I mean, I don't think anyone was precious about, you know, we won't work with you or whatever. I mean, it's like any of these initiatives, it tended to be who was around and whether people were, you know, wanted to. You know, nothing seemed to work if people dug their heels in a bit, you know, so nothing's going to work if people are going to be precious. So just get, if you don't want to get involved, fine, don't get involved. You don't need to criticise us for doing whatever we're doing, but just don't get involved. That's fine, great. No, you do your bit. I think that, particularly in the community-based housing associations, again, it would be kind of interesting for you to kind of follow up with some of the people who were involved from that side of the fence, but I think a lot of them understood that dynamic. I personally found it a bit disappointing later on, you know, when I was working for Scottish Homes and Community Scotland in the 2010 kind of period, that a lot of that early dynamism of the housing association movement seemed to have been kind of dissipated. And I mean, not, you know, there seemed to be, I came across people who sort of would say, well, our management committee says to me, Glenn, you know, we're a housing organisation, what are you doing getting involved in other things? We are here for our tenants, we do housing. And, you know, it was kind of disappointing that folk couldn't kind of, some people who, and they are working to the management committee, so I can understand it, but it was kind of disappointing how some people would seem to think there was kind of one thing. I mean, housing only regeneration doesn't work. Everyone learned, well, you would think people would have learned that, but maybe they didn't. Employment-based only regeneration doesn't work. Nothing works, you know, if it's just a single discipline type response. It has to be far bigger than that, far wider than that. So I personally was always dead keen to try and work with people like housing associations and projects, and when I was with Scottish Homes and Community Scotland, we did some good work using this budget we had called Wider Role, which it was there to give housing associations a wider role in regeneration. whereby you would come up with some interesting projects that would involve them in things other than housing. It might be employment, it might be credit, it might be training schemes, but just to come up with new things. And that, to me, again, looking at the literature down the stair, was one of the other good things. I mean, working in an organisation like Strathclyde Community Business, no one had done it before, so we were all making it up. And, you know, there was it was just this kind of spirit that, well, we haven't tried that before, let's do that. And folks seemed to be up for that, so that was good, you know.
Do you remember any of the projects or any of the research you did that tried to make that, tie that link between housing and jobs together? What kind of outputs came from that kind of thinking?
I'm trying to think of anything specific off the top of my head, but I mean, the Housing Corporation in Scotland, which became Scottish Homes, was very forward-thinking. A guy called Jim Hasty was the kind of lead guy in the Housing Corporation in Scotland, became the Development Funding Director for Scotland for Scottish Homes. Associations were not kind of directed only to do housing, you know, so I'm struggling to think of anything, you know, an actual example. But, you know, there were lots of housing co-ops, like, you know, there was kind of Postle Housing Co-op and there was Postle Community Business. There was Calvey Housing Cooperative up in Easterhouse, and they got involved in community business. Ballanert Community Business. So there were these examples. If I can just, I'll probably remember other things as we keep talking, you know. Yeah, there were definite examples of that. I mean, from my perspective, after I left community business, I got involved in a thing called Care and Repair, which was essentially trying to target repair and improvement grants. Housing repair and improvement grants to older owner occupiers to help them stay in their homes, rather than, you know, what had tended to happen was that they couldn't look after their home, they couldn't do the repair, so they got shunted into long term hospital, which cost the state tons of money, whereas if you'd just done a wee bit of work in the house, they could have stayed in their house, and it saves money. But I tried to look at that also as something a bit wider than just housing. So I tried to do initiatives that involved housing, social work, healthcare as well, in care and repair. That was one of the things that got me to in the 80s, I suppose, was just how somebody talked about the eternal verticals of departments. And that's what it seemed to be. You know, you had social work, which was like a skyscraper thing called social work. Then you had another skyscraper called housing. And then you had another skyscraper called planning. And then Glasgow District was a skyscraper, and the region was a skyscraper, and SDA, you know, and no one talked to each other, and no one shared. This was in the days before, you know, kind of community planning or the ideas of folk working together and sharing budgets. It was kind of, that's your problem. You know, point the finger. That's your problem. We don't do that. You do that. You sort it. You know, so there was a fair bit of that going on, and that was, you know, we're going back to what we're talking about, keeping going. I mean, how do you keep going when people say, that's not my problem, I don't do housing, or that's not my problem, I don't do health, or that's not my problem, I don't do planning. We're the SDA, we don't do economic development in poor areas like this, we only work with private sector entrepreneurs. So that, you know, it was just incredibly hard to. So I think, looking back, given everything that we were up against, I mean, it's amazing what happened in terms of the energy, the enthusiasm, the successes, The other thing, just in case I forget later on, was towards the end of the decade in the 80s, the thing, sometimes I felt like the sponsors of community enterprise, so community business, it got, as the thing grew and got bigger and you got numbers of community businesses employing big numbers of folk, your Postles, your Barrafields, and organisations like that, at some point, Flagstone Enterprises, some points they were employing 30, 40, 50 people. So 30, 40, 50, 60 people cost an awful lot more than two or three people. So if a business employing 40, 50, 60 people goes bust, which inevitably businesses will go bust, but there was almost this feeling around in the late 80s, by the late 80s, that we can't let these things fail. And, you know, you kind of went, well, you know, of course it's going to fail. Things are going to fail at some points for all sorts of reasons. And an awful lot of it was cash or cash flow or whatever, but an awful lot, or it could be bad management, or it could be a bad investment decision. But private businesses go bust all the time. Now, the important point is, why did it go bust? And but you know, there was this, no, it was this more doom and gloom, you know, Barrafield's gone bust, oh God, that means community business can't work, you know, and this kind of air of collective doom that kind of descended by the late 80s, just because one business employing 40 or 50 folk failed, and was quite interesting, you know, and kind of did give a bit of a kick in the belly to the kind of impetus that had been built up. But I don't think, I mean, I think it was used as an excuse to sort of kind of, the model's not working, it's all a bit kind of utopian, it's all a bit kind of wishy-washy, it's all not enough business-oriented. And when you were operating in a kind of strict Thatcherite regime and local government cuts and SDA being told to work with private enterprise and, you know, councils, I mean, to be fair, you know, there was a fair amount of money going, not much in the great scheme of things, but there was a fair amount of money going in. So if something fails, you probably want to know why, but if the why had been kind of investigated a bit more, kind of, you know, a bit more robustly and sympathetically, rather than looking for excuses to get people or dump the model or whatever it was, there certainly wasn't, to me, a lot of lessons being learned then. It was more about people not getting on with each other by that stage.
And was that pressure coming from within the movement or outside?
Well, I don't know. As I say, it's kind of hard to try and remember now, 35 years on, but I'd written down a few things about, you know, I mean, the thing that I remember about the 80s was just how, I mean, I don't remember it particularly fondly as a time that was, you know, I mean, it was, you had the Cold War going on in the background internationally. You had Reagan and, you know, all these old men that were the face of the Soviet Empire. And then you had Gorbachev came along, which was like, you know, a ray of light, you know, it was brilliant, you know. But it was a kind of desperate international scene for a long time, you know. Cold War, as I say, going, but it did get better, and, you know, Soviet Union collapsed eventually in the late 80s. But you did, throughout the 80s, you had a right-wing privatising government that showed no signs of letting go, you know, and it just, and, you know, you had Mrs. Thatcher famously coming up to, you know, the General, whatever it is, General Assembly of the Church of Scotland and starting lecturing them about we in Scotland. And, you know, I don't think the Conservative Party's ever really recovered from those years. And to try out the poll tax in Scotland for a year before they introduce it throughout the UK, I mean, that's just unbelievable insensitivity, you know. So there was this always this thing about let's try it out in Scotland, or it's a guinea pig. So while I'm being vaguely critical of people and sponsors of SCB or whatever, I mean, you've got to be conscious of the fact that these officers and politicians were working in very, very difficult times as well, and you know, they had a hard enough life without perhaps, you know, one other thing going wrong and having to cope with that. But generally speaking, I thought what we did in the 80s was really quite, it was interesting work, it was innovative work, it was a new response. We had fantastic interest, not only from other bits of Scotland who perhaps weren't developing as quickly as we were doing in Strathclyde, but also throughout the whole of the UK. We had people coming nearly every week here and asking us about what we were doing and going round the businesses. And I mean, it actually became a funny thing in that we had to eventually ask people to make a contribution, because you know, we were asking people to give up their time from running a business to tell them, well, how did you get started and what are the issues and what's it like sacking folk when they so you know, you actually had to say, look, can you give a donation to the business? So that was quite interesting. And also internationally, you know, there were tons of people coming internationally to find out what we were doing. So I mean,
and what was drawing those people in? What were the kind of innovations that you guys were putting into practice that was really intriguing people?
Well, I think it might have just been this kind of idea that there was a third way to do it, that it didn't need to be private, it didn't need to be public, that you could do this kind of third sector way of doing it, involving local people and placing them at the forefront. And I think that is also one of the better things that in Strathclyde we were good at promoting it as widely as we could. You know, we published a lot of stuff, and I think that's the value. You can see that down the stair now. There's a body of work down there that actually charts what was going on. And as I think I said in one of my notes to you, was I don't think there'll be anything like that anywhere else in the UK at the time. Of that detailed record of what was happening. And it is fairly honest, you know, because I mean, it's not all gloss, and it wasn't, we weren't just saying this will work anywhere, or you know, I think we were coming at it from a point of view, you know, let's try something new, let's try something different. It might not work, but let's find out if it works. Let's see why it works, or get, you know, let's have a look at it. And I think it was just we were coming up with some kind of answer to what had become a very stratified kind of policy context between left and right, and we were saying, well, there could be something else in here, you know, do you want to have a look at this? And folk were going, yeah, that sounds good. So yeah, I mean, internationally there was tons of interest about what we were doing.
I'm trying to think about the types of communities where this work was taking place. Was it in the kind of peripheral housing estates that had lacked any kind of infrastructure for a local economy, or was it in areas which had a strong kind of industrial identity, but that had been decimated in the process of deindustrialization? You know, was there any particular kind of community where you felt this kind of work took hold the best, or did it, you know, what were the dynamics there?
That's an interesting one. I mean, in Glasgow, for example, I was thinking about this just kind of walking in there. You had the likes of Govan I mean, I'll tell you a story about Covenant, and it's in that little pockets of hope. British shipbuilders, you know, the Govan Yard, Jimmy Miller, who was one of the directors of Govan Workspace, tells this story in there about he had this delegation of people from the German shipbuilding industry came over and from Hamburg, and they took them a wee drive round. You know, I think they met them at the airport, and then they had a bus, and they were taking them round Govan to show them what the kind of community was like. And he said, after a wee while, the guy sitting next to him, who was his counterpart, the training manager for this yard in Hamburg, was getting more and more kind of sad looking. And Jimmy kind of eventually said to him, "Look, what's wrong with you? I mean, you okay?" And the guy goes, "Well, this is like 1980 or something." And he goes, "Look, I'm really, really sorry. I'm sorry that we bombed this place so badly during the war." And you know, he actually thought it was the Luftwaffe that had bombed Govan and hadn't rebuilt it. You know, and like Jimmy's going, "Well, no, we actually did this to ourselves. It wasn't your bombs. It was us that did this." So you had that going. You know, so you had places like Govan. You had Springburn that had built a motorway or dual carriageway right through Springburn. Mary Hill was going to have another motorway going right up through the canal and Mary Hill Road. That one got shelved, but I mean, it would have been the same thing for Mary Hill if it. So the AMA charged right through the city. It's the only city in the whole of the UK that's got a motorway running through it. So you had areas like that, your Govans, your Springburns, your Mary Hills that had been completely devastated, but still very strong sense of community. You know, that when they say in Govan, you know, you call yourself a Glaswegian, but a Govanite's a Govanite, you know. And you still had that in place, those other inner city areas. Now, in terms of your peripheral housing estates, your Drumchapels, your Pollocks, your Castle Milks, etc., you could argue, was there ever really a genuine sense of community in those places? I mean, you look at a map of Glasgow before the war and the one after the war, I mean, it's like completely different. You know, it's like twice the size after the war because they had these huge big things stuck on the outside, rather than 1 million folk kind of piled into this fairly small area. And even within, I mean, like, how can you talk about a community of 40,000 folk or 20,000 folk? You know, I mean, like, there's huge constituent parts of a place like Easterhouse. You know, it's not just Easterhouse. It's like, you know, it's the size of Perth at one point, practically, you know. This thing about what was a community was quite interesting, you know. So in the likes of Easterhouse, you know, you'd work in a place like Bar Lanark, because Bar Lanark was a separate part, one of the component parts of Easterhouse, but it identified as a place. You know, the people came from Bar Lanark, they didn't come from Easterhouse. There was no right or wrong. You just worked with whoever was coming forward with ideas, who wanted to just try something. And what we were doing in Central Belt had in a large extent been predated by the work in the HIDB, the work in Highlands and Islands, the community cooperative program. Which was set up by the HIDB in 1977. HIDB had this very far-sighted chairman, as he was called at the time, Sir Kenneth Alexander, who had been the principal at Stirling University, who HIDB was interesting because it had from the outset in 1965 or 66, whenever the Wilson government set it up, the regeneration of the Highlands and Islands was seen as not only an economic thing but a social thing as well. So the HIDB from the outset had a social and economic regeneration dual role. And you can see that you saw how that worked, you know, in the way that, you know, the policy responses here was all about, it was either economic regeneration or it was social work or something, you know. It wasn't, these two traditions didn't come together in the Central Belt very well at all. And, you know, like one of the guy in the region said to me, he said, you know, he seemed to think I was some sort of community business evangelist. And he goes, you know, when you say community business, you're probably seeing community with a big C in it and B with a small B in it. He says, but where I come from my perspective here in the Regional Council's Industrial Development Agency, I see business with a big B. And I'm saying, well, I'm not really saying that at all. I'm just trying to, I think if you're talking about getting any kind of enterprise or economic activity going for unemployed people in some of these areas, I think you're probably doing a bit of both. But I mean, that was a key thing that didn't get married up down here. That I think we suffered from for a long, long time. You know, you were seen as wishy-washy, or you didn't really know anything about business, you know, and you're just a bunch of social workers or whatever, you know. Really disparaging, not horrible comments, but, you know, comments that just failed to understand what the nature of the issue and the problem was. And that kind of attitude wasn't going to sort anything for anybody, you know. So I think that was the great thing about the HIDB program. So we're talking about community, and that's why it worked in your Barras, your Harrises, your Helmsdales, your because people, it was so. If you're on a fairly small island, there's clearly a sense of community there, or a small town, that's harder to kind of engender or promote or project or whatever the word would be in, you know, in Easterhouse as a concept of 40,000 people. I said that, I remember thinking Dick McGlave, who was another guy who was involved in Government Workspace, one of the other directors, he told this story too about, and this is just what it was like in the 80s or 70s, when Government got flattened basically, and his mum, who had been born and brought up in Government all her days, she was in her 70s or 80s, and they flattened her house, her tenement, and sent her out to Easterhouse to live 8 miles away from where she knew everyone, you know. And he just said something like, you send a woman, an 80-year-old woman, away to a place called Easterhouse when she's lived in Govan all her days, you might as well have sent her to Australia. And this is like pre-mobile phones, pre-everything, you know. So if you did do that, I mean, I remember. It was that you were flung away, you know. So people did, a lot of folk, I'm not saying everyone, but, you know, if you had a community like Govan, which was very integrated, close-knit, okay, there's 90,000 folk living there before the First World War, in this tiny area of the city, but I mean, it was very much a community. Now, can you say the same thing about some of the communities that were created after the war? Not really, you know. So, you know, that was the thing about the third sector in those days. It was very much community business or community enterprise, whereas the social enterprise thing now has become much more a kind of wider model. It's a kind of model of enterprise rather than, you know, so it's much more kind of generic, you know. It doesn't need to be community based, and the community holding assets and you know, the kind of, I've never really kind of got into the legal side of it too greatly. John was great for that, but you know, the idea that he's this asset, you know, the asset lock thing, when I came back to community social enterprise about 10 or 15 years ago, and a lot of talk was about the asset lock, you know, I just thought, well, that's absolutely fundamental, why are we even having a debate about that? But back in the 80s it was all about community, and I think that was the other thing about one of the challenges that we didn't get, that you were constantly up against. We drew the parallel quite often between housing associations. By the very fact of a housing association developing, you're acquiring this colossal asset base. So you're creating a successful business by definition, because it's all going onto the balance sheet. You know, you've got a building, it's worth blah blah millions of pounds, you know, as it kind of, one becomes 10, becomes 100, becomes thousands. Whereas the kind of community business model was always under, you know, it was undercapitalised, and we kind of racketed about for bits and pieces of money from here or there, but the main source of funding we in Strathclyde Community Business had to help things get started was the Urban Programme, Urban Aid Programme as it was called, and all we could do for any business was stick in a £30,000 management grant, which in those days would pay for about a manager and an administrator. So it was like a £30,000 subsidy to get things going. And it would be time limited for 3 or 5 years. I think 7 years was the limit you could put Urban Programme into anything. But, I mean, clearly that's not tailored to anything. I mean, that's just like, it was 30,000 quid for business A, 30,000 quid for business B, for business. So it not only limited what you could put in, but it probably limited the types of activity you could do. Because a whole pile of business was automatically excluded because you needed big money to do that. So that again, I suppose, was one of the other debates about, you know, how do you move between, get away from low wage, low value work to something a bit more exciting, you know, or and that was difficult. That was really difficult because there wasn't the money around. I mean, you've got. I can't remember what they called the investment bank for community enterprise now, Scottish Community. You know, anyway, you've got an investment bank specifically for community enterprise now. In our day, you didn't have any kind of source of private funding. That's why we set up, for example, SCEIF, Scottish Community Enterprise Investment Fund in 89, as a response to that, to try, because the private sector wasn't going to invest. Public sector was precluded from doing it largely, so we came up with this idea, well, let's do a shared issue. You know, this is what I mean about, you know, we're constantly trying to come up with something new and innovative. So we did a share issue to basically the public and enlightened organisations to invest in a fund that would basically provide capital for businesses. So that was great fun doing things like that. And we raised I think the share capital thing raised about 250,000-300,000. Because when that investment bank for Scottish Enterprise was trying to raise something similar about whatever it was, 8, 9, 10 years ago, you know, I said, well, the guy was saying, one of the chaps from that company was saying, I don't know how we'll get on. I said, well, we did it 20 odd years ago, and it was like, we got more than a quarter of a million, so I'm sure now in the kind of more enlightened atmosphere that we're dealing with or living in, you're bound to get it, you know, because I think he was looking for £2 or £3 million, but I think that was just a ramble about how difficult the funding situation was. There wasn't anything tailor-made, and so
and did did you have aspirations with those kind of the potential for larger funding? Was it about trying to rebuild some manufacturing output in communities who had lost that, or what were the kind of bigger ideas or aspirations around?
Well, again, as I say, I'm not, my skills never lay in tax or legal side of things, but I was interested downstairs, and I think it would be important, interesting for future researchers to look at that, because in 1985 we did this thing called Manifesto for Community Enterprise, and this was more like John's side of things and other people who were kind of Stephen Phillips from Alexander Stone and people like that, there's the solicitors, Burness now, and that was about trying to create a tax situation that would encourage the opportunity for not only private investment, but it looked at things like VAT and registration, how to make that whole process simpler. Because there were enormous loops that you had to go through. Again, this all officialdom depends on stringing you out. So, I mean, but there you are, 1985, there was a 10-point manifesto for how the process could be simplified. Now, I didn't have enough time in our 45 minutes to remember all the bits and pieces we were arguing for, but I bet you half of them haven't even been done now. That was one of the other things, just in case I forget, Jill, about, you know, we regularly consulted with all the political parties, because we were very keen to try and reach out to all political parties. This was not any kind of, none of us were kind of party political people, you know, we were just trying to chart this new way of doing things. And it must have been the 87 general election, we met with all the Scottish political party leaders, which was interesting in itself, about, you know, meeting people like face to face, like you and me, and that was fascinating. And then taking them out for a wee drive and going into your apostles and Easter houses and getting them to see exactly what it was like, because I know you always see pictures of politicians and whatever, but I mean, I wasn't quite sure that a lot of them had kind of walked round Allender Street and Postle before, it's like, I was remembering coming in, John Mackay, Lord Mackay of Clashfern, as it became, he was a good guy, he was very nice, affable, friendly, forward-looking, one-nation-type conservative. He was the kind of lead person for the Scottish Conservatives, and he was of all of them at the time, he was the one that I found that was most conducive to having an interesting chat about things. And took him round Postle, and he had his John Mackay, vote for John Mackay, in the back of his big car in Allender Street in Postle, and I'm saying, John, I think we might maybe just turn them over or something. And he got it, you know, he kind of totally got it. It was interesting, you know, so there was like Jim Sillars from the SNP, there was Malcolm Bruce from the Lib Dems, it was Bruce Milan from Labour in those days. But anyway, so it was all fascinating, you know, having these one-to-one discussions. We'd talk through, for example, the manifesto and what we were trying to do. But it wasn't as if one party was all for it or one was all against it. It just fell into one of these grey things that you then had to try and pitch in and say, this is what we're trying to do. Do you think, would you be interested in that? Your party could sponsor, could come round to supporting this kind of way of doing things. And by and large, they did, but the colour of the money wasn't always there.
And so when you were trying to, did this part of your work, were you trying to shape policy and try to get this, cross, social economic divide, were you trying to make inroads into that? And at that time, was that like the Scottish Home Office that you were trying to work with, or was it down Westminster? Obviously, this is pre-devolution.
Yeah.
How was the kind of the whole policy sphere on your radar? Were you trying to influence it, or were you just trying to make the best of what was coming your way?
I think this is the kind of key role Community Business Scotland played in all of this. Community Business Scotland was the national network for community business, and it basically didn't have any staff. Well, certainly not to begin with. To begin with, it was just an association, really, of all of us who were involved from across the country, and we did things, 1984, we put out the first community business directory, and 1986, we put out the next directory, and that again was just part of the process of trying to push a kind of idea to get it kind of more widely out there. It was pre-social media, it's pre-everything. It was the published word that tried to get the message out. And, would circulate material widely, and probably it would just fall in empty desks mostly. But Community Business Scotland, I think, played a key role in all of that. And one of its key roles was helping to create and promote the case for development units like Strathclyde. And CBS largely was responsible for setting up all the other development agencies out with the HID, Highlands and Islands area, so that by the late 1980s, I think every area but Borders had some sort of development agency. And George Burt, who should be mentioned as again one of the key figures for Community Business Scotland, George had a key role in doing that kind of legwork to create development units in every part of every region, because it was seen as a regional council kind of led thing to have development agencies. So George played a key role in that in the mid 80s certainly. But yeah, you're right, politically it was very Westminster oriented. I mean, the region, the local government was seen as a sort of countervailing, the best kind of countervailing force to kind of countervailing force to the worst excesses of the UK national government's policies locally, So it was a very, very difficult operating atmosphere throughout that period. And I think we it's really important to constantly refer to that. But maybe I'm doing it far too much. Maybe I've just made it more complicated than it was. But why did we keep going for so long if it was that difficult? I mean, it couldn't have been all that difficult. But the scale of the challenges were. And you see, that's the other thing people forget about. You look out that window now and you see this beautiful university and the garden. Nothing. Glasgow didn't look great in the 80s. It was battered, it was bruised, it was kind of getting the miles better thing was starting, but there were still huge areas that had been knocked down that hadn't been rebuilt. And that would be reflected, the industrial fallout of the clearance, the industrial clearance that happened in the late 70s and throughout the 80s was there to see. It was kind of grim a lot of the places, and there wasn't colour. My abiding image of a lot of the 80s was a sort of greyness, even architecture was still grey, it wasn't colourful. So I suppose we were just trying to get that colour going to some extent in places that had got far too much share of their, as Oscar Marzarouli called it, shades of grey, you know, because that's what he felt, shades of grey, that's what Glasgow, you know, his book about Glasgow, shades of grey. Grey. So, yeah, but I'd hate to think that I'm making it sound some sort of desperate thing. I mean, it was, as I say, I mean, there were great folk around, there were, but it did, I mean, going back to what was said earlier, it did seem to rest on quite a few limited number of folk locally to keep the thing on an even keel. And then I think by the time the 80s kind of wound up, there was a kind of new model of community enterprise, wider model started in.
And what was ushering that in? What was changing at the end of the 80s that was provoking those that change?
I don't know. Well, you know, we talked earlier about one or two of the bigger businesses failed, and I think a lot of folk thought, maybe some of the sponsors then thought, well, you know, we've tried that, let's try something a bit more business oriented, and maybe there was more money coming in then, and maybe there were new models, and you know, an awful lot at the end of the day. I mean, like, everything's about, you know, they say it's politics, it's not personalities, but an awful lot of it is personalities, you know. I mean, it's like, who's running the region, who's running the district, who's running the SDA. I mean, that colours an awful lot of what actually happens on the ground. You know, we don't like that person, let's get a new person in. And so, you know, and I think there was a kind of, I was away during the 90s, so I kind of lost track a lot. I mean, so I'm not qualified really to talk about what happened in the 90s, but by the time I kind of came back up in the 20, middle, it's like 24, 25, 26. There was certainly a kind of new generation of folk around, and that was great, and there was a far greater acceptance of community enterprise, social enterprise as a kind of concept. And but some of the big challenges were still there, you know, like, how do you get public sector markets? How do you get into growth areas? And you know, then you were getting exciting, really great things happening, like the whole environmental thing had taken off. You know, wind farms owned by communities, and the whole land reform thing. I mean, that's a new dimension. That's brilliant. You know, that's just, the scale is just so much bigger than it was. Back then, you know.
So can we go back to that time and look at a more your personal trajectory? When did you move away from Strathclyde Community Business, and what was your next job?
All right. Well, as I say, by the late 80s, I can't remember when Barrafuel collapsed. I think it was 89 or perhaps into 1990. And there was a feeling that I think even probably those of us who were around, who had been around for throughout that time, like Duncan left. He ended up here, actually, Duncan. And Colin had left, and you know, and I think the kind of model that we'd been pushing, I ended up being John's deputy in Strathclyde, and I think they wanted a new approach, the sponsors, and people like Ron Young, Tony Worthington had left to become an MP, Ron was starting to do other things, so an awful lot of the kind of the folk who'd been around, both politically and as officers, were moving on. So it was a new generation. Fine, great, you know, that, I mean, that happens. So John left, and then I just left when he left, because it was just kind of not going to be the same. So I went away and I went back to housing for a while, and as I say, I came back to social enterprise, and it was kind of interesting to see what had changed and what hadn't changed. And generally speaking, I think what we achieved was quite remarkable given the conditions we were operating in. And I think there's, as Colin also said, I remember in his interview, he said there's things going now that were set up then. I spent, just rolling back to where we started, I've taken a couple of my friends in the last 2 months to the latest facility that Govan Workspace has developed in Govan Road, the former former Fairfield Shipbuilding Company offices on Govan Road, which I was saying to Carol and David down the stair, they really must go and see in yourself if you've not been. It's absolutely fantastic, you know, and you see the video of what that place looked like, and I mean, it's just fantastic when you see things that are going 40 years on, or 30, 40 years on, and inspirational. Brilliant.
And what? How? I mean, two big, changes in the infrastructure of Scotland really would be the kind of reshuffling of local government in 1996 into unitary local authorities, and then of course devolution and the creation of a Scottish Parliament, which really changes the landscape that people are operating in. Coming back into the sector in the kind of early 2000s, post those changes, do you think that has made a difference to the way people are working today?
I think so. Again, I haven't been, as I say, my kind of main time in this was in the 80s, so I was only ever really peripherally involved ever again. Well, fairly minor role. Communities Scotland had started to have a kind of wider regeneration role by the early 2000s, and as I say, the policy context was much more accepting. The thing that doesn't ever seem to get cracked to me though is this issue about procurement. How can social enterprises get into the real big service delivery contracts? Now, that seems to be a nut that perhaps there are great examples around. I mean, as I say, I'm not really au fait with what's particularly happening on that front, but you know, like health contracts, but that's more about like health and social care integration. That's now been going on, I don't know, what's that, about 10 years now, and it doesn't seem to be hugely integrated even yet. So you're just dealing with back to these eternal departments, as someone called them. The eternal verticals, in fact, that was it, the eternal verticals. Public sector procurement, yeah. I mean, is the public sector set up to deliver big contracts through third sector vehicles? Is it in their interest to do that? Is it set up legally to do that? I don't know. But local government is still the big service delivery organisation, and it farms out an awful lot to the private sector. I'm not quite sure how much is going out to the third sector right now, or whether what's going out to the third sector is seen as a cheaper alternative than doing it through their own people. Cheaper stroke better, but cheaper being the operating word. Maybe, I don't know. But yeah, as I say, the other thing is that, you know, but you do see the impact in great initiatives like land reform and environmental enterprises, which is good. But as I say, I suppose when you're as deeply involved, you kind of have to go away and do other things to kind of get your brain working again. Sometimes you can get too sucked into something if you just sit in it for too long. And I mean, possibly I was in it too long myself in the 80s and became a bit of a dinosaur myself. Who knows?
One thing I always find interesting about social enterprise is there always seems to be a bit of a, you know, within the different models of organisation that you can call a social enterprise, there's some that are more community orientated. There's some that are more kind of enterprise with a kind of social arm orientated.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see the balance and of that working, and you know, what are the benefits of, are there benefits of one over the other? Or would you even agree with me? Maybe you disagree entirely.
No, I suppose I'm running out of anything new to say now. I think as long as it's a local response to whatever's happening, and I think that theme that I maybe touched on at the beginning about how do you keep the thing moving, how do you keep regenerating it? I mean, I've got the same issue. We have a community garden in where I live, for example, and you know, it's just the classic social enterprise kind of model. You have tons of enthusiasm, people get involved. And I remember writing an article about it. Somebody had done their, you know, as part of a university essay or something, one of the people who'd been on the committee. And I said, the problem would be if we think this is done now, we've set the garden up. I said, that the work only starts now. We now have to keep it going, and we have to regenerate ourselves and rejuvenate and re-everything. And you know, we're just like the same kind of microcosm, you know, because we're now down to four folk, you know, it's the same four. And somebody's on our Facebook page last night moaning about dogs using it to pee in, and why don't you get involved, you know? Why don't you come, I'd rather complain than do anything about it, you know? I'm maybe being completely wrong. That person might become fully involved for the next 15, 20 years, just like me and a few others, but they might rather sit back and say, well, why don't you do something about it? Well, why don't you get involved? You know, so as people have to kind of, the thing has to it's Doctor Who, you have to regenerate, you know?
Yeah. So do you have any, if you were given a few tips to people starting out today, facing those problems of keeping people interested and keeping people going, was there anything you found particularly worked well in trying to do that?
Don't know. No, I don't know. It's the perennial, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, but I did marketing when I did my degree, and you know, it's like what they always say, if you stand still, you're dead, you know. So any business, any community initiative, anything has to do something new, or else it'll outlive its time. And that's the good thing about community enterprise, you know, it's kind of moving on, it's got new interpretations, it's got new legal models, it's got, you know, so who am, you know, I welcome all that, I think that's great. Because what happened in the 80s is what happened in the 80s, you know. It's right that it probably ended in the 80s or new versions of it took over or it became new versions because, you know, it wasn't going to exist out with the 80s, you know. So, but I think as a body of work, what happened then was important, was exciting, and it tells a story down the stair about what it was like operating in that context, and I think it's a very useful contemporary account that I hope your future researchers will get something out of. Mm.
Likewise. I don't have any further questions. Do you have anything to
I think you've extracted anything I can possibly remember from 35 years ago out of me. So thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Glenn. Stop the recording.